Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Laura Glenn. Glenn is a poet, artist, and freelance copy editor. Her work has appeared in many literary journals, including the Antioch Review, the Massachusetts Review, the Healing Muse, Poetry, and Boulevard. She is the author of two collections of poetry, I Can't Say I'm Lost, published by Foothills Publishers in 2008, and her just-released beautiful new chapbook, When the Ice Melts, from Finishing Line Press. And welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tish. So wonderful to be here once again.
Now, I want to talk, obviously, about the new collection. When the Ice Melts comes almost 10 years after your last collection.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's still about memory and time and nature. And so has anything changed in your idea about poetry through these last 10 years?
Yes. Some things have changed, in part because of things in my life that have changed. The death of my father and the necessity to give more attention to my 95-year-old mother, that has had a huge impact on my life. My son growing up and leaving home. Certain political events that have really gotten to me and have been forcing the, I want to make a little pun and say passivist into an activist. but although I'm not really as activist as I could be. And I also think that, I think we discussed this at the end of the last interview, that as I get older, I think a little bit more about what I want to convey to the reader, the listener, the audience, which doesn't necessarily mean that I won't write about whatever I feel compelled to write about, but I'm more aware that words do have an impact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know what I noticed in this collection, because obviously I've read both of your collections, you seem more present in this one. You know, more inside it instead of standing outside and watching. I found that very interesting.
Wow.
Do you think that you're more involved in the poems themselves instead of being just an onlooker?
Well, I never would have thought of that, but that seems real to me. I do feel as much as I hope on some level to reach universals and get away from the me side of poetry. I think I'm right there. Not to say that every poem is based on absolute truth. There are things that are fictitious, but in general, yes.
Yeah, and to me that means somebody with more experience has come to the drawing board, you know? And you're probably, like a lot of people, a little bit more comfortable with who you are. That's what I find poets evolving into.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's a wonderful point.
Yeah, I did notice that. Now, tell us, what kind of foundations do you build to create these poems? Does it start with one line? Does it start with a title, an emotion? Tell us.
I think it starts from a number of different angles. Sometimes a metaphor will come to my mind and kind of be glowing in the dark and begging me to pay attention to it and build on it. Other times, you know, I'm trying to process a difficult situation and, you know, turn it into poetry, turn it into something that will help me to reflect back on the situation from a different vantage point of, rather than that of pure emotion. Sometimes I just write lines down that occur to me, and they're kind of orphan lines looking for families, and I build on that. So I think there are a number of different ways that I approach poems. And in a way, a lot of it is visual versus, you know, purely emotional, but the two always converge.
Yeah. It's very clear in your poetry. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to have you read a poem from When the Ice Melts. This one's called Eternity. Tell us a little bit about it. I'm taken by it.
Okay. Well, there are two major concerns in the poem Eternity, which is about Emily Dickinson. One is an interest in her concept of eternity versus immortality, the concept of living on through the written word. I refer to in stars as asterisks at the beginning of the poem, and the quote that I'm referring to at the beginning of the poem is about the loss of a loved one who she transforms in her mind into a star among stars. That star ultimately transforms into an asterisk or the written word. So it's kind of like living on eternally through the written word. On another level, what really sparked the poem was something I heard years ago that was incubating in my mind for a while about how if Emily Dickinson were alive today, she would be giving readings, she would be on the internet, she would be self-promoting. And whereas I really appreciate that feminist sentiment, and I certainly support it on a, just in reality. On another level, it seemed to be at odds with how we view Dickinson as the kind of archetypal inner poet, poet of inwardness, who also, like all of us, all creative people, and probably like everyone, is an ambivert, partly extrovert, partly introvert. But she was a very inward, private person. So,
go ahead and read Eternity to
okay.
us.
Eternity. For what are stars but asterisks to point a human life? In the dark planetarium of your imagination, you wonder, if Dickinson were alive today, how bold would she be? How public, like a blog? See that constellation connected in cyberspace? Not Virgo with her shaft of wheat, but Emily Dickinson, pen in hand, in her long white dress. Among the stars, countless as the number of times Emily considered eternity, imagine her bending rules on the internet, or self-promoting, then keening, exulting. From that domed, pensive place, think of Dickinson wheeling through cyberspace. If she stumbled, or if she were dissed, would her diadem of stars scatter like wildflowers on the field of study, or shatter to dust of nebula?
I love that. Because, I think Dickinson wouldn't survive in this culture.
Right.
I really do. And it amazes me how much people are still taken by her. She has permeated everyone's culture, it seems.
She really has it. Yeah. And she is almost an archetype. She was called the myth during her life. And she still is that today, but she's also very real. And, you go back to her poetry, and it's still so vital, and it's a great escape from the today's reality, and at the same time, it brings us right back to it because it's so universal.
Oh, yeah. This is there's a culture of so much junk out there, too,
mm-hmm.
and it's so wonderful to read this kind of poetry that's obviously been thought out in great ways. Now, that line, that poem brings to mind a question that I have. Do you think social media and the internet has helped keep poetry alive for us? Because it is a language that doesn't really seem to be conducive to such a, it's a short attention span culture.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I do. And I don't, one thing I realized is after we talked, I'm reading two poems that deal with technology and networking and the media. And I think there are many wonderful, wonderful things. Witness the show, that mm-hmm. that gets reaches a broader audience and really gets people interested. And a lot of people think poetry should be read. I agree, although I also think that there are things that appear on the page that can be very important and missed when it's read. It works both ways.
Yeah, you're talking about read on the page or out loud?
There are some things that are on the visual written page that get missed, certain line breaks and, mm-hmm. Punctuation that can contribute to the meaning. But so often a poem is really brought to life when it's read aloud. So I think that all of the changes in technology have been really good for poetry in some ways, but there's a downside for me. Probably as somebody who came to all this technology later in my life and was a little overwhelmed with parts of it, there is it works both ways.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. Yeah, it does. But it does keep the language alive in places where mm-hmm. it never would have reached, I think. Now, you're also a visual artist. Mostly you do abstract work. Your poetry is less grounded in abstraction, so do you think your poetry is, easier to decipher because of that? That it's not so grounded in abstractions as your artwork?
Well, I'm a poet who likes to make at least some things clear. I realize a poem can never be too clear. The poet, while working on the poem, is often struggling with what is being said, and it isn't really known until the end of the poem, if ever. But I do really appreciate getting getting a grip on some of the basic things going on, and that's my orientation in writing. It's not like I want every poem I read by other poets to be that way. For some reason, I'm very abstract in my painting, and I don't know. I puzzle with this. I think abstraction is almost like another language for me.
Yeah,
and it's a nonverbal language. It's so hard to explain the way I make decisions when I work with abstractions in mm-hmm. art.
Yeah, the paintings are definitely more mysterious than the poems, at least for me.
Oh,
at least for me. And I appreciate both.
Oh, thank you.
I love your abstractions. I think they're absolutely gorgeous. Now let's read another. Let's have you read another from When the Ice Melts. This one's called Cyber Mom. It's autobiographical for sure. Tell us a tiny bit about it.
Okay. Well, this poem was written after my son left for college, and during the late teenage years, he was, as most youths his age were doing, he was breaking away from home and defining his independence, and it got a little extreme at times. Things are a little different now, and we see each other more often. But for a while, I felt that my strongest connection to him was through Skyping.
Great. Well, please read it for us.
Cyber Mom. I talk to you on the screen. So what if I can't kiss your forehead, smell your hair? Hair long, hair short, beard on, beard off. I watch you play with time, playing with you. Sometimes you pixelate, like a Chuck Close painting. Still, I feel close to you. And grateful for Skype. How else would I make it through months going on years away from you? Or maybe it's gotten too easy to feel connected. Maybe if not for Skype, we'd see each other more. Your father and I watched DVDs on the large TV you bought back in high school with money earned on eBay. Otherwise, we haven't touched a thing in your room. Except the fish tank that livened your desk. In early autumn, I hauled the glass box to the duckweed pond and released tiny frogs I grew from tadpoles. All that's left is a snail named Ed Sullivan. As a young child, I imagined tiny people inhabiting the TV like fish in a tank. Now you're my favorite show. I watch you, and you watch me. Or we glimpse ourselves on small squares beneath the larger ones. You can turn me off when I start to dispense advice like an annoying ad. Or you can email me something we're talking about while Skyping. I can shoot you this poem, read it across cyberspace. It's always a treat to see you. It's not half bad to be half robot, though sometimes I'm half sad.
That's great. That's got to be the sentiment of so many parents whose children grow up and leave home and lose the real close connection. Yeah. You know what I'm going to ask you, too? When your poems are about family like that, do you censor yourself? Do you worry about, how much you're revealing?
Well, yes. For a while, I really was reluctant to write about family members. And you can write in code and never reveal who you're writing about, and I do that sometimes. But even though I vowed to be careful about family members and make sure that I don't get, like if I'm writing about my father, that I don't get caught up in some moment of remembered anger, but rather keep the balance in the relationship of, what was great and what was problematic. So I try to do that, and I also, with my son, I asked his permission after I wrote the poem to include it in the book, and he gave me carte blanche for including whatever I want. I guess he trusted me, but I think I will continue to ask him with individual poems if they're okay.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet and visual artist Laura Glenn. We're talking about her newly released chapbook, When the Ice Melts. You know, a lot of poets I've talked to and read about feel that once a poem is written, it no longer belongs to them. Do you feel that way? I know Louise Gluck said that, and I've had other poets say that. Do you feel like it doesn't belong to you after you've written it, and you send it out, and it's no longer your child on the subject of children?
It depends on the poem, but with many poems, I feel like as I read them, they kind of garner more meaning. When I, you know, I remember after my son left, I had written Cyber Mom, and I read it at a few readings, and I kept choosing to read it, and I felt like I was working something through and feeling the connection as I read the poem. Mm. And similarly, one of the poems about my father, I really enjoy reading it and remembering kind of how I experienced things after he died. The poem was kind of a substitute for some of the pain.
I remember that poem. You were packing up his stuff, right?
That's a different one. That was when they were moving. But that poem too, I enjoy connecting to it. Right. But some poems, I was referring to depth perception, and the other one is shred. But it's true for both of those poems. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, but some poems we do kind of leave behind, and they become a little alien to us.
Yeah, yeah. I often wonder if writers get annoyed when somebody interprets a poem wrong. That's my baby, you know? How dare you? You know, a lot of painters say, you know, whatever people see visually is not my problem, but a poem seems more personal most of the time, you know?
It can be upsetting, and it did happen with this book, with the poem Flight, where I was being very metaphoric about, you know, difficulties in a relationship, and some people interpreted what happened in the poem as being real, and it wasn't, and it gave me pause.
Yeah, I remember Audrey and Rich said that to me, too. Please don't assume that everything I write is about my own life. Yeah, and that's true. People need to keep that in mind. Now, I know you work as a freelance copy editor, mm-hmm. so who do you choose to have a separate set of eyes when you're ready to put your work out into the world? Do you just do your own editing?
There are some poems that I just write and work on. I revise a great deal. Spend a lot of time on most poems. But I am in a poetry group that I've been in for a very long time, and there are a lot of poems that I get stumped on. I feel as though I can't bring it to the next stage, and having other eyes look at it, other minds, other beings, is very helpful, especially with people who you trust and feel that, you know, they're going to be critical, yes, but they're ultimately being supportive. That balance is important. And then also, sometimes my husband will, sometimes I show him poems because he is a really good editor.
Ah, okay. So the copy editor gives up her power at certain points. That's
right.
Interesting.
It's really hard to edit your own work.
Oh, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, I know. Now, I want to have you read a final piece from When the Ice Melts. This one's called Ice Creek. Tell us about it. It's definitely about our area.
It is.
It is.
So
our snowy, icy area.
Yeah, it was about an area when the water was rising in the ice creek, and we had to have a lot of intervention to kind of pump the ice away and chunk out all the ice that was clogging the creek. And the poem ends up dealing about, in a way, appreciation of beauty in nature, regardless of whether it comes from something good or something bad, as in the case of climate change. But at the same time, their responsibility to try to change the world and think through how we might be contributing to problems such as climate change. Mm-hmm. Ice Creek. The green engineer says knowledge ruins his appreciation of beauty, even sunsets. Shell pink blurring into lavender, a nacreous cloud glorious with pollution. Weren't there sunsets before? Even if sometimes it makes the sky beautiful, must I despise the colors? I worry about warming, but still, the colors. Maybe I don't feel bad enough. Today, the creek overflows, water rises. Sump pumps do overtime, as do firefighters bailing out basements. City workers barge in, smash ice chunks that jam the creek, claw them out with the long arm and huge hand of a scoop crane. Leafless lilacs along the creek lose limbs. Crushes of ice and bitter water rush under the bridge, lined with watchful neighbors. Kids pause by roads turned into barricaded ice rinks. Toward evening, volunteers pass sandbags, pile them like plump pillows to ward off watery nightmares, fitful sleep. The unfrozen waterfall roars in the background. I find a beautiful thing in the mess, a rain-darkened branch sprinkled with celadon green lichen. It twists and ramifies, narrows at zigzag angles, bears delicate blooms of fungus like cherry blossoms. Maybe the young engineer was right. Ice creaks like an old door opening. Crossing a bridge absorbed in the branch I brandish home, a layer of feelings begin to thaw and mix. I sidestep a puddle hosting an oily rainbow.
That's great.
Thank you.
You know what I love, too? I love that line, I find a beautiful thing in the mess, because that, to me, is what poetry is about.
It is.
You know, that's very, very telling to me, that line.
Well, I want to always find the beautiful things in the mess. At the same time, in a way, in this poem, I become like the green engineer who can't appreciate the sunset. By the end, I'm doubting myself for being so indulgent as to appreciate the beautiful thing in the mess and to take in the whole experience on some aesthetic level. But I do agree with you that we do have to keep finding beauty in life and fight against the ugliness that can be changed.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's even beautiful in wreckage, right? I mean, and that's what we have to worry about. We don't want to find it so pretty that we don't work against it. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
In regard to especially what you're talking about, climate change.
Yeah, and that happens in my art. I do digital art as well as painting and collages. And sometimes I'll begin with, broken windows. They're just sometimes wreckage is beautiful. Sometimes layers in ancient city, crumbling cities are beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, we have to appreciate, but keep the right perspective in mind.
Was it hard for you to switch from painting to digital art? That seems like an interesting segue for artists who have worked in other mediums, especially the traditional ones, of course. How did that work for you?
Well, it's more of a tangent. I like to work with my hands and to have the actual materials are satisfying to me. But I was very critical of digital art when I first saw it. It all kind of looked the same, and it seemed clunky, and I didn't like it. But once I started experimenting, I realized you can really get some amazing original effects. And the cover of When the Ice Melts is based on a photograph of some scrap metal, some beautiful silver-colored scrap metal that I arranged. And I just, I Photoshopped beyond recognition and then kind of found I have the water flowing through it and the hot and the cold colors. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's a beautiful cover.
And almost what looks like a female figure walking uphill, the uphill struggle. Mm-hmm. If you work hard enough with any medium, you can come up with something that I think can be appealing.
Yeah, and beautiful, actually. I think that cover is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
And also the title, When the Ice Melts, to me that sounded so poetic. Because, when the ice melts, it reveals all kinds of stuff underneath it.
That's so great because, I want to reveal different layers. And you know, some people have said when the ice melts, oh, it's like when, or, you know, when the ice breaks in a relationship.
Oh.
And other people have noted the connection to the ice creek and global warming and all those dangers. But I see it on multiple levels. You know, I see it as a relationship with the ice melting. I see that as potentially feeling dangerous, the overflow of emotions and the need to kind of protect ourselves from that. And then the literal dangers, as well as literal dangers of, literal melting ice.
Uh-huh. I see the revelation of secrets.
Yes,
of the ice melting. And,
that's perfect.
And found objects, magical stuff underneath that.
Yes.
That's interesting. That was the first thing I thought of. But yeah, I love titles with so many different meanings.
Yeah, that was what I liked about the title. I was hoping it would work on a number of different ways. If I can add, I also, in the back of my mind, I thought of the lullaby, Rockabye Baby, and When the Wind Blows.
Oh, yeah.
When the wind blows, a cradle will rock. But then how does that song end? Down will come baby, cradle and all. So the kind of soothing, welcoming, warm title that has the potential hidden danger. I mean, that rhythm of that lullaby for some reason kept coming to mind after I chose the title.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left. I just wanted to ask you about, you mentioned that you have to block out time to finish books and to write poetry.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make yourself write when you do that? It seems to me poetry just flows from some people, you know, whatever you're doing, pumping gas.
Right.
But do you really have to map out time?
I've been having to leave town a lot because of elderly relatives, people having difficulties. And so much of my time, it's harder and harder to block out time. But having my poetry group helps because it helps me to complete things, at least bring it to a certain point where it's ready for a critique if I haven't been able to complete it on my own. But I'm constantly writing little scrappy notes, and I have on my computer, I have a little file called Isolated Lines. It's just filled mm-hmm. with things. Some are probably tiny poems that I just have to tweak. But I do it however I can approach it. When I have the time, I take it, and when I don't, I write the little notes and store them up.
That sounds like every poet I've ever met. That's beautiful. I love it. Can you give some contact information?
Yes. I have a website, Laura Glenn Poet and Artist.com. So LauraGlenn Poet and Artist.com, on which you can see examples of my poetry and art. And there's contact information if you would like to get in touch with me. I would love to hear from you.
That's great. Well, Laura Glenn, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, we've been talking to poet and visual artist Laura Glenn. She has a new chapbook. Go out and get it. It's called When the Ice Melts. It's beautiful, and you will love it. And thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you so much, Tish, for having me here. And thank you so much for having this show in general. It's such a wonderful thing.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.